I've been teaching the Hebrew and Christian scriptures for about over 30 years. And there's something wonderful in that experience. You get, I believe, much closer to the heart of what this whole operation is supposed to be about. But you also see how complicated it is. You encounter the contradictions, the reversals, the inconsistencies of Scripture. And you see exemplified that old Portuguese proverb that God writes straight with crooked lines. So I'd like to, because I have tried for a couple of weeks to make sense of these three readings simultaneously, to take them separately and to show them as instances of what this kind of inconsistency and the interesting problems that it raises. And I'm going to cheat a little bit by going to last Sunday's gospel, which was the same thing as the call of the disciples, but instead of in Mark's version, in John's version. You may remember it. It's not much different from what we have today. The Gospel of John is one of the most interesting documents in the New Testament. It almost didn't get canonized. It was not until the second century that we have somebody who was so-called Orthodox quoting it, because it was always used by Gnostic heretical people. And it was the last of the Gospels to be canonized. And you can't read the Gospel of John adequately without reading the first letter of John. The problem was this. The reason they didn't want to canonize it is that the figure of Jesus in the Gospel of John was so superhuman, so inhuman, that he hardly seemed to fit the image of Jesus that we get in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This Jesus knows everything. This Jesus can do everything. This Jesus is not baptized. This Jesus does not have an agony in the garden. This Jesus kind of sails over everything. You remember? Probably the easiest example is in his arrest. You know, he says, in Luke, Jesus is prostrate with grief. The Johannine Jesus just standing there, and these guys come, "Who are you guys looking for?" Jesus of Nazareth said, "I am he," and then they all fall down. Drastically, radically different picture. So they figured that the Gospel of John grew up in a community that was geographically and certainly ideologically distant from the other communities where Matthew, Mark, and Luke's Gospel were written. But what is interesting, what I'm getting to in a kind of roundabout way, and I hope I'm not wasting your time, that the Gospel of John we'll have all this talk about God is love, and you know, who lives in God lives in love, and all this wonderful stuff. And the Johannine community busted. All you have to do is read that most interesting document in the New Testament, namely the first letter of John, where part of that community calls the other part the Antichrist. The very same document which you have all this wonderful God is love talk. So some cataclysm occurred, and scholars believe that it occurred because part of that community, the larger part most likely, thought they were impeccable. Literally, thought they were beyond sinning. And so it foundered on that issue. And so in the first letter of John, you have this extraordinary thing. At one point it says, we cannot sin because we're in the light. But then about three pages later it says, but if we do sin, we have an advocate with God. What I'm getting at is clear problems that are raised by these texts, which we say are normative. And they certainly are normative. It's no surprise that Luther called on sola scriptura, scripture alone, as a basis for faith. But it's not a simple or immediate faith. Just as our reading of these texts must not be simple or immediate as well. So what do we do about a community that thinks it's beyond failure? It's not a it's not just an old problem, it is a current problem as well. Paul's letter to the Corinthians talks about husbands and wives pretending they're not married, and all the buyers and sellers pretending they're not buying and selling. And you remember this is a continuation of the passage on sex last week that I tried to say something useful about. What Paul is doing is simply spelling out his own belief that God was going to send Jesus back immediately. Paul thought he would be alive when God sent Jesus back to judge the world and shut down the whole spatio-temporal continuum that is our existence. To the day he died, he believed that. All you have to do is read his last letter, the letter to the Romans. He was convinced of that. And that's why, and people need to keep that in mind when he talks about all this sexual abstention. He's saying, well, don't distract yourself, that's what he's saying. Just as don't worry about the new sales at Masonville or, you know, how your livestock is doing. Don't worry about all that stuff because it's all going to be finished very soon. The interesting problem that arises from this text is this. Jesus didn't return. So what do we do now? What do we do now? How is this movement going to continue? Well, we know how it's continued. It continued by establishing a bureaucracy. We see this in the Gospel of Matthew. And then when Constantine comes a couple hundred years later and legitimates the whole thing, we have basically an institution that takes on all the coloration of the Roman Empire. It's language, diocese, bishop, all those words. Paul doesn't have anything of that in any of his letters. He said the church was to be organized because God was going to give the members of the church everything that was needed to keep that community going. Just like that. Patty bringing the thing, we got Rita doing the thing. There's going to be charisms, gifts, and that's the way the church was to operate. Max Weber talks about charismatic communities. But how do we move from there to where we are today? Where do the charisms lie in the church today, in our church? Because, let's face it, 2,000 years, Jesus still hasn't shown up. An extraordinarily important question, seems to me. Jonah is called a prophet, but it's basically a fairy tale. A big fish swallowing him, plays taxi, delivers him to where he didn't want to go. But the theology of Jonah is very clear. This was written by some Jew to counter the Jewish assumption that they and they alone were the object of God's concern, mercy, etc., etc., etc. So somebody who wrote this thing created a worst-case scenario, said, we're going to send this little joke to the Jews' greatest enemy, the bloody Ninevites, and preach God's mercy to them. That's why Jonah got caught up by the fish. If you know the story, I don't have to go through the story, but Jonah was trying to escape. I don't want to do that. Who wants to talk to those bloody Ninevites? The point here, well, there's several that are very interesting. The Jews themselves canonize this. The Jews themselves cast themselves in this terribly bad light where they consider themselves so narrowly that everybody who was not a Jew was damned or in the outer darkness. But they had to choose, you see. And this is the beauty of the inclusion of this text in the Bible. They had to choose this self-depiction. In other words, it's the very opposite of the self-congratulatory community we see in John before it busted. So in every instance here, we have God writing, I propose, straight with crooked lines. The danger for us, I think, is to stop at any point in that scripture, that writing, to say this is normative, this is over. In other words, we have to be ready to see that the world is a fairly untidy place. That nothing often enough is what it seems. That religiously, nothing can substitute for one's own conscience to make a judgment as to what is authentic in this tradition and what is inauthentic in this tradition. Because if we don't do that, we betrayed this God who made us and made us to be free and made us to understand and think about our world. And so I think, as I've been wondering about what a mess Scripture is, it is a mess. It really is a mess. But the very fact that the Jews chose this messy, contradictory, inconsistent thing ought to be a lesson to us who want so much clarity, who want so much certainty, who want to know who's in, who's out, who's good, who's bad, who's right, who's wrong. The narrowness, unfortunately, that characterizes me as a human being and certainly the Roman Church as an institution. And this is not some kind of angry screed about this. This is the truth, it seems to me, if you're going to take this stuff seriously. This is the truth. And as 1 John will say, only the truth will make us free.